Good morning. I'd like to welcome you this morning to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Bryce Hobrock. I am a member of this fellowship, and I am your convener today. Whatever journeys you may have taken in your life to seek knowledge, enlightenment, fame, or fortune, we are glad that one of those journeys has brought you to this fellowship here this morning. We're glad that you're here today and hope that you can find the program of interest. Our programs are varied, sometimes presented by a minister, our minister, a guest minister, member of the congregation, or others with expertise in a topic of interest. If today's program is not to your liking, well, give us a chance. I'm sure that you will find something of interest now and again. We are a welcoming congregation, open to every race, creed, and preference. If anyone is new today, I encourage you to sign the guest book at the entrance. If you would like to know more about us, there are many here who will be glad to tell you what we have to offer. If there's anyone new today who would like to introduce themselves, please do so at this time. Okay. We would now like to light the chalice. It is in the experience of community that we come together as individuals, hoping to reaffirm our belief in justice, fairness, and concern for others. I light this chalice in this spirit. There are announcements printed in your bulletin on the right-hand side, and I have two additional announcements to make this morning that have been handed to me. And this is from the Committee on Ministry. The Fellowship's agreement with Michael Nelson calls for a regular assignment of the state of the ministry in the Fellowship. The Committee on Ministry is in the process of doing this now. They will be talking with a sampling of the fellowship and inviting input from everyone. Please take part when the opportunity arises. The second announcement is that if you would like a permanent name tag and have been operating only with a temporary at this point, I ask you to please speak with Shirley Hobrock or Inel Forrester right here. They will coordinate the acquisition of a name tag for you. The opening hymn this morning is number 291, Die Gedanken sind frei, which in translation means thoughts are free.
Sin fry.
It is now time for joys and concerns. Feel free to express thoughts of things that have happened in your life or the concerns that you have for others.
Shirley Holbrook, I have a joy this morning. We have a new member. Yusha, would you stand up? Yusha Redding. Welcome, please.
I just want you all to come and celebrate Dick's 85th birthday and also our pleasure in being part of this congregation.
It's a joy to be here today and see all your wonderful faces. Oh, I'm Edith Hendricks.
It's Michael Littlefather. I am the interim caring chair because I've just been to the hospital to visit Jack Warren, and after 10 days or so there, you can see marked improvement. He reminds you more of the Jack of a year ago than the Jack of 2 weeks ago. And he and Alice will be moving to assisted living. They are yet to decide among the three alternatives, but they'll move probably later this week. He still appreciates gifts at or guests at. Well, I'll take gifts too, if they're particularly valuable and useful. He's just doing a whole lot better. It's a great treat to see him doing so well.
And Kathleen Oldfather, and she didn't mention it, so I just like to let you know that Shirley Holbrook broke her clavicle, and so she would like your sympathy, but not your hugs today.
Speaking of people who aren't here, if anyone knows anything, what's new with Anne and Bernice in Maine, let me know after the service.
Marilyn Caldwell, last... So I'm okay? Okay. Last week, I told everybody I was fearful of the cataract operation and asked for everybody to give good thoughts my way. It worked. I'm here.
Okay. Thank you for those thoughts expressed and unexpressed. They are very important to those in need to know that others are thinking of them. We will now have the children's conversation, and Kathy will take over.
Good morning. Hi. Well, I'm Kathy, and I wrote a story just for you. Because we're traveling today in our imagination in RE, since everybody else gets to travel in here. All right, so this is my story for you. Once upon a time, a young boy in Egypt had a dream. How many of you know where Egypt is? Oh, a long ways away on the other side of the world. Raham dreamed of the future, not tomorrow or next year or 100 years, but 3,000 years away. His dream was full of children with bright eyes and curious minds. They lived in a land so far away, his father's fastest falcon could not fly there in an hour or a day, even though it flew through the Sunday and the moonlit night. Raham woke up in tears, realizing he would never know these beautiful people. They would never know he existed. All that would be left of him would be dust blowing in the Sahara or a teardrop falling into the Nile. He was so sad he couldn't sleep. He heard his father, an artist for the Pharaoh, working in his shop down below. Since the days were burning hot and stone carving was difficult, his father worked by night by oil lamp. Raham crept down the stairs and peered into the shop. His father was tapping lightly on an alabaster lion with its tongue. Alabaster is a white stone. On an alabaster lion with its tongue sticking out playfully. That's not rude in ancient Egypt. That meant laughter, not an insult. Raham knew it was a gift for the young prince, Tutankhamun. Only the best artisans created work for the royal family, and his father was the best of them all. When his father sat down the statue and stretched, Raham tapped lightly on the doorframe. "Father, shall I pour you some fresh water?" His father knew instantly that his son was troubled. Raham was a boy who studied hard and slept well. Nighttime visits were rare. "Yes, my son, you must have known I was in need of company. Please." He motioned for his son to sit on a stool nearby. Raham and his father both drank deeply, and Raham told his father of his dream. His tears threatened to fall on his bronze cheeks, but he blinked them back quickly. His voice shook when he finished. "And they will live, never knowing of me or you or even our little Tutankhamun." His father reached out and touched his son's bare shoulder. "Ah, but you are wrong, Raham. You have a great gift. You are becoming a scribe, learning to write the sacred hieroglyphs, and you have an artist's hands of my father and his father before him." His father picked up the little lion and brought it near the lamp. Along the base, he had carved tiny shapes of reeds, owls, and snakes, spelling out a blessing for the baby prince. His name, Tutankhamun, was carved on a medallion on the lion's chest. He said, "Read this." Raham traced his finger along the base. "May Ra give thee light, laughter, and eternal life." "I do not understand your meaning, father." His father answered, "Someday, 1,000,000 years from now, a scholar may hold this in her hands." Could you put your hands up like you're holding the little lion statue with the tongue sticking out? Okay, perfect. "She will be able to read what I wrote by the lamplight while you were sleeping. Perhaps she will read the words aloud, as you did, and wonder what happened to Tutankhamun and to me. And in that moment, I will live again. You, my son, will make beautiful things, rich with the poetry in your heart. You will write, and those words will live forever." Many years later, Raham worked by lamplight in his goldsmith's chambers. He tapped lightly on a small golden chest covered with figures of the pharaoh and his young wife. As he finished the last words of the love poem around the rim, he thought of his father and of the children who would someday see his writing, his masterpiece. Raham smiled and whispered, "In that moment, I will live again." Go now in peace.
I would now like to introduce Susan Reed, the executive director of the Flint Hills Community Clinic, who will speak to us briefly concerning our Helping Hands program.
Good morning, everyone. First, I'd like to thank you for having me here this morning. Come to tell you a little bit about the clinic, and I very much welcome questions because I understand a lot of people don't know where we are or that we exist or what we do. The clinic has been in Manhattan since 2005, and it provides primary and acute care for residents of Riley County and Manhattan proper that are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guideline. So it's a low-income, completely free clinic. Anything we do in the clinic is free. We also refer out to local specialists. Right now we have 65 local specialists in all different areas that take patients for different needs. We also have, since I believe it was October, had Dr. Rose, Dr. Graham Rose, come on. So we have a pediatrician now, which we didn't have before, which is pretty exciting for us. We also are in the middle of, I'm new at the clinic, relatively new. I've been there a year. And our clinical coordinator, Linda Davies, also is relatively new. She's been there since last December. One of the things that we have looked into changing in the clinic, or I guess bringing to the clinic, is more emphasis on things like diabetes control, maintenance, things like that. So in our grant writing and our funding, one of the things that we have done is gathered money so that we can provide free insulins and free needles and testing strips and glucometers for diabetics to help, you know, keep them testing like they're supposed to and compliant. We are also looking into some of the other things like asthma. We have a lot of patients that have asthmas or COPDs, and those medications, inhalers and things like that, are quite expensive. So we are looking into funding so that we can provide those free of charge to some of our patients. So I would love for you to ask me any questions, anything that you don't know about the clinic that I can help you understand a little better. Yes, ma'am. The one thing that we don't have yet is any kind of a contract with transportation in Manhattan. We are looking into Attabus and the local taxi service to see if they will partner with us to help provide some of that, but we do not have that as of yet. Yes, sir.
Where are you located, please?
We are at 401 Houston Street in the Area Agency for Aging building. We are down in the basement.
Just a quick comment. I know that you have a local citizens board.
Yes.
That oversees your work, and mm-hmm. I hear about you through my wife, who's on that board.
Okay.
You do great work. I'll testify to that.
Thank you so much.
Can you accept unopened bottles of non-prescription or prescription drugs?
That is something that we can accept those, and we partner with other places to try to get those medications places it'll be used. We sent a lot of medications to Haiti last spring. Because of our rules and regulations in the United States, though, if it comes from a private individual, we cannot give it to another patient here. But we do, if people bring those in, we do try to find some outlet that we can give those medications to where people can use them. Yes.
Do you have needs for volunteers?
We always have a need for volunteers. Yes, we do. Right now we are looking for clerical volunteers, especially during the day. Betty can attest to that for me. Someone to answer the phones. It gets pretty busy in there sometimes with the phones. And we would love to have any of you come down and just take a tour if you just want to come down and see what it looks like and see what we do. Just come on in. We'll walk you around. It's a very small space. But anyone else?
Okay.
Our administrative hours were there from 9 to 5, Monday through Thursday. We are there on Fridays. Those are our catch-up days. But our clinic hours were 5 to 7, Wednesday evening, Thursday evening, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday evenings. And then Dr. Rose is there from 1 to 4 on Thursday afternoons. Sorry. Thank you.
I'm going to change the order of service just slightly and follow Susan's previous presentation with the offertory. Remember, in our Helping Hands program, that any cash that is put in the baskets today that is not in envelopes designated for your pledge or other credit, that that cash will go to Helping Hands. And any check that is not specifically written and designated for your pledge or the fellowship will also go to the clinic. It's a very worthy organization. Sometimes you wonder why we need things like this when we have, we struggle to provide health care. It takes many, many hands and efforts in trying to provide health care to those in need. So we'll do the offertory now. Thank you. As a prelude to our talk this morning by Elka Lorenz, I would like to present the following reading titled, You Can Come Home Again. You Can Go Home Again. It is an American canon that states, you can't go home again. This is taken from a posthumous 1940 novel of that same name by Thomas Wolfe, where he explored the changing American society of the 1920s and 30s with reference to the stock market crash, the illusion of prosperity, and the unfairness of growing old. The phrase entered American speech and became a metaphor for once you have left home, you cannot go back to the old forms and systems of your childhood that seemed so everlasting at the time. Nevertheless, we know that a young man or woman's dreams of glory and fame can only be realized by leaving home and seeking them in a changing, wider world. Once you have left your country town, farm, or provincial backwater to see the world, you cannot return to the narrow confines of your youth. Attempts to relive youthful memories will always disappoint, even though we try. We often interpret this title, You Can't Go Home Again, too broadly, however, because it's come to mean that you can't return to the place of origin without being considered a failure. Well, that is quite incorrect, because there is great value in returning home to retrieve memories that should not be lost. We should treasure those memories as they are important to understand what we became. You must go home again. You can go home again to understand who you are. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker, Dr. Elka Lorenz, a longtime member of the fellowship, who will talk about some of her recent journeys.
Good morning. I really am not going to go down memory lane too much. I like new experiences, and I like to combine travel and culture and going back to places I know. But above all, I like to see new places and try to feel very at home there as well. So I do have kind of a broad concept of home. Mark Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Robert Louis Stevenson, there are no foreign lands. It is the traveler only who is foreign. And Samuel Johnson, the use of traveling is to regulate imagination by reality, and instead of thinking how things may be, to see them as they are. The official title of today's program went from the program committee version of Unification, with special reference to healing the individual, family, and national disruptions that often linger in the aftermath of war, to Going Home, Coming Home, Reflections on a Recent Visit to Germany, to a medley of the two topics with some digressions. I meet people all the time who say that they have been stationed in Germany in the 1960s, and that they have heard that things have changed a lot over there, and if that is true, they usually say that with a tone of regret. I have to confirm, yes, Germany has changed a lot. It is not stuck in the 60s or the 1930s or 40s, the period a lot of people still associate Germany with if they've never traveled there. I usually point out the fact that the United States has changed a lot since the 60s as well, and that most cultures change over time. It is easy these days to travel to the Western and Southwestern German states and not think about the Second World War, Cold War, or the 1990 unification. However, traveling to East Germany, it is still quite impossible not to think at least about the time of the DDR, the East German state. The historic distance makes traveling to the East remarkably interesting and less depressing than it might have been just a few years ago. I've always liked to combine travel, work, and leisure, and it turned out to be especially rewarding this year. It started out with leaving for Germany and a short stop in the Czech Republic with a 15 and 16-year-old student and two adults from Manhattan High School. We were quite a group. My travel companions had the energy and interest to be out and about from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m. for 8 days in a row. Traveling can be tiring when you're not used to it and when you go to a region that you're not familiar with, which was the case for my four travel companions, but they were relentless. They wanted to see every great site and museum they had time to visit in Berlin, Dresden, Prague, Nuremberg, and Munich and its surrounding area. They were interested in the history and the popular culture of each place. They were even ready to watch a football match during the Soccer World Cup on big screens on the fan mile under the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin with nearly 400,000 other fans. They were a little wary of the fans with beer bottles, but luckily we did not encounter anything that would make me cringe too much, and I cringe easily when I'm with students. They listened attentively to our British tour guide in Berlin, who, with great sensitivity, pointed out the suffering of the city and its people during World War II and its aftermath, lasting 45 years longer here than in the West. We had, during the same tour, the opportunity to walk through the labyrinths of the Holocaust Memorial dedicated to the murdered Jews of Europe. Both, hearing about the extent of destruction endured and walking through the Holocaust Memorial, leave a powerful and probably lasting impression on visitors. Our city tour also led us to the Checkpoint Charlie Museum that, among many other things, showed the role the American Armed Forces played in the protection of West Berlin during the Cold War, which, of course, made the American visitors feel good about the role their country had played in defending the city for nearly 50 years. An interesting tidbit worth of sharing is that the German Chancellor and head of the German government, Angela Merkel, grew up in East Germany. Her parents moved there in the 1950s and stayed. Thus, she is not only the first female chancellor, but also the first chancellor from the East. She studied at the universities of Leipzig and Berlin and holds a PhD in physics. She's a conservative who speaks Russian fluently. Our tour guide pointed out that she does not have a residence like the White House or Downing Street number 10 or the Palais des Champs-Élysées. She rather has an upscale apartment in the center of the city in close proximity to the people and to the government quarters. I found that a bit surprising, but assume and hope that she also has private quarters in the chancellor's office. The German president, Joachim Gauck, who was voted into office by the German government only recently after his predecessor abdicated because of some scandals, is also from the East. He was a Lutheran minister, instrumental in organizing mass demonstrations that ultimately toppled the communist regime in 1989. So far, no scandals have been associated with him, and hopefully Germany will have a president who, unlike his two predecessors, will be able to fulfill at least 1 5-year term. He, by the way, resides in a very nice palace, the Palais Schaumburg, in the center of Berlin. Just the chancellor who does all the governing and thus most of the work does not have such a nice residence. I wonder whether it's her East German upbringing that makes her so modest in that regard. From Berlin, we went on to Dresden, a city that also left us with a strong impression. The structures of the Zwinger Museum and the Semperoper were fabulous. We were able to admire Raphael's painting of the Sistine Madonna in the permanent exhibit of Old Masters. It is the painting that at the bottom shows the two little angels that we all have seen. We visited the Frauenkirche, such an important symbol of destruction caused by war, which some 60 years later became such an important symbol of reconciliation.
An American on the tour with us told me that visiting this area made him feel really bad because of all the destruction inflicted upon the people there. I told him that there are a lot of places that make me feel bad too. I would like to read a short poem by the leftist German poet Bertolt Brecht, one of the most important 20th century German writers. This is a translation. While Brecht spent the war years in exile in California, he did not write in English. Everything changes. Everything changes. You can start anew with your last breath. What happened, happened. And the water that you poured into the wine, you no longer can pour out. What happened, happened. The water that you poured into the wine, you can no longer pour out. However, everything changes. You can start anew with your last breath. From Dresden, we continued to a one-day visit to the Czech Republic. Prague is a city of great charm and memorable sights. The city and its people suffered plenty before and during the Nazi occupation and the communist regime that followed. But it is fortunate that it was spared the destruction many other cities faced. It did struck me as odd that our tour guide, who was obviously very knowledgeable about the city, its architecture and history, did not mention with one word the considerable Jewish history or the Jewish quarters of Prague. It left me and my two colleagues from Utah and Ohio, who happened to be AP European history teachers traveling with history students, with a feeling of discomfort. We all independently and unaware of the others' plans took our students to the Jewish quarters on our own in the afternoon. I found it personally gratifying to see how well informed these history teachers were. From Prague, our tour went via Nuremberg to Munich, regions very familiar to me, actually. We saw Dürer paintings in Nuremberg, and we toured Munich, visited museums, went to picturesque Oberammergau, Wieskirche, Ettal Monastery, and Neuschwanstein Castle, thus ending our tour in what is arguably the most beautiful and scenic part of Germany. After sending the group back to the United States and staying with my sister south of Munich for a day, I started my next adventure going back east to Leipzig. Leipzig is located about 130 miles south of Berlin in the federal state of Saxony and has over 530,000 inhabitants. A group of 15 German teachers from all over the United States, at the invitation of the American Association of Teachers of German, spent 2 weeks at the Herder Institute of the University of Leipzig that houses the German as a foreign language program. The program was focused on schools in the Leipzig area, but also on history and culture. The two latter ones will be of more interest to you. A German teacher colleague from the San Francisco area and I had accommodations close to the city center in the apartment of a retired former University of Leipzig teacher. This in itself was highly interesting. Anne Rose, in her early 70s, bringing the world to her by hosting students from all over the world to her three-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment. While Nancy and I were there, Anne Rose also hosted a student from Lithuania for a semester. Eva had to move to the living room couch to make room for me. I'm sure she was glad when the 2 weeks were over and she could reclaim her room. At breakfast, in the kitchen, Anne Rose told us stories from the old days of East Germany. I should have written them all down every night so I would remember them, but I didn't. She used to teach psychology to future teachers at the university. She must have been what we would call unauffällig, or unconspicuous. That is, she did not speak out against the regime, or I'm sure she would neither have gotten her job, nor would she have kept it. Her older son was denied entrance to the university because his father, a medical professional, was not as careful as his wife. Parents everywhere want the best education for their children. And in East Germany, that only could be had if not only the young person, but also the parents conformed. In order to get a spot at the university, a young man also had to commit to 3 years of military service, which must have seemed like an eternity, especially if assigned close to the border with West Germany. Enlisting for 3 years often occurred under great pressure from the family, wanting their son to be able to go to university, from teachers, classmates, youth organizations, you name it. The novel, play, and movie Am kürzeren Ende der Sonnenallee, at the shorter side of Sunny Avenue by Thomas Bussig, deals with that topic. We were able to see the play at the University Theater with the students playing and singing their hearts out, recreating the lives of a group of youngsters living in East Berlin close to the wall. The Sunny Avenue was a street divided by the wall, the longer stretch of the street in the west and the shorter stretch in the east. I like one of Thomas Bussig's quotes. It is simple but not easy to translate because German has two words for memory, where English only has one. I'll try it anyway. Happy people have a bad memory, but rich memories. That is probably true for happy people around the globe. Here is a joke that I remember a guide in the Forum for Zeitgeschichte, or Museum for Recent History, told us about life in the East. Someone broke into the office of the head of state, Erich Honecker. Honecker was really upset, and when asked what was missing, he replied, "The election results of the next 20 years. I wanted to mention that on the 4th of July, the director of the Herder Institute invited us for a champagne reception at 11 in the morning, right there on the premises of the Institute. Just so you know, it was not against university policy to serve champagne in the morning. He gave a speech that centered around German-American friendship and what it meant to him personally. He was born in 1940 in Berlin and was an 8-year-old boy. And as an 8-year-old boy, was one of the children eagerly waiting for the Rosinen bombers to drop candy during the 1948 airlift. As a young man, he traveled to the United States several times. His children both studied in this country, and one of them got married to an American. Since the American Consul General residing in Leipzig took a day off on the 4th of July, he was only able to receive us a couple of days later, but he made up for it by also serving us champagne and giving his speech in German. His high school German teacher would have been really proud of him. His name was Mark Powell, and I heard that he was a nephew of General Colin Powell. I will certainly share that story with one of my students who wants to become an ambassador. Leipzig, also called the city of Johann Sebastian Bach, has a remarkable cultural history. The city recently applied for the status of UNESCO World Heritage Site for music. Bach was the cantor of the Thomas Church in Leipzig from 1727 until his death in 1750. The Bach Museum is across the street from the Thomas Church and well worth seeing and hearing. The Thomas Church in 2012 celebrated its 800th birthday, and so did the famous Thomanic Boys Choir. It was a special treat to attend a choir performance of Bach Motette by the choir in the Thomas Church with the Gewandhaus Orchestra playing. But it was not only Bach and the Thomaner Choir who contributed to Leipzig's status as a city of music. Richard Wagner was born in Leipzig in 1813, the year of the famous Battle of Leipzig that ended the Napoleonic Wars. The composer Clara Wieck, who later married Robert Schumann, was born in Leipzig in 1819. The couple spent the first 4 years of their marriage in Leipzig. The Jewish composer Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy lived as the conductor of the famous Gewandhaus Orchestra in Leipzig from 1835 until his death in 1847. Mendelssohn was also instrumental in keeping the memory of Johann Sebastian Bach alive. In 1936, the NSDAP ordered the mayor of Leipzig, Karl Gerdeler, to have the Mendelssohn statue to be removed. Gerdeler refused, but in his absence, his deputy removed the statue. Learning about this, Gerdeler resigned his post as mayor of Leipzig. In July 1944, he was involved in the failed assassination attempt against Hitler and subsequently hung. But back to the music. Other famous composers living in Leipzig were Albert Lotzing, Edvard Grieg, and Gustav Mahler. There are many other noteworthy music connections to Leipzig, too many to point them all out to you. Talking about Leipzig and its cultural history requires to mention that the German quintessential writer Johann Wolfgang von Goethe studied there from 1765 to 1768. In his most famous work, Faust, Goethe devoted a whole scene to Auerbach's Keller, a pub in Leipzig where students liked to hang out. Mephisto and Faust made fun of the students and played some magic tricks on them. Auerbach's Keller, to this day, is Leipzig's most famous restaurant. Friedrich Schiller, also a very famous German writer and collaborated with Goethe a lot. He also lived in the city of Leipzig. I have mainly talked about the east of Germany, but I need to at least mention the relationship between the east and the west and recall the peaceful demonstrations that led to the fall of the Berlin regime that actually started in Leipzig. The rebuilding of the east, including the cities of Berlin, Dresden, Leipzig, and Weimar, I just mentioned those because I know them, to name just a few, has cost and still costs West Germany about 5% of their gross domestic product annually, and about 30% of that of the east. I read somewhere that up to 2009, that totaled 1.6 trillion euros. It shows in what dire state East Germany was at the time the Cold War ended. While I know that many West Germans do resent how much the rebuilding of the East cost them, I always looked at it from an outsider perspective. My family had returned to the US in 1989, shortly before the wall fell. I remember working out at the YMCA in Florence, South Carolina, when I first heard about it. It was so unexpected that I simply did not understand the newscasts about the toppling of the wall. It took me a while to comprehend what had happened. To me, the people of East Germany have carried the burden of the outcome of the Second World War 45 to 50 more years than the West Germans. That is almost two generations. Things in the West got a little bit better every single year after the Marshall Plan of 1948. It got a little bit worse every year for the East, or at least it stagnated. People for years did not even have enough to eat, and structures that were not destroyed during the war deteriorated often to a point where they could no longer be saved. To top it all off, the East German regime sometimes tore down historic sites that actually could have been preserved. An example of that is the University of Leipzig Chapel that was now rebuilt in a modern form. 45 years of hardship versus 45 years of steady growth and increased standard of living does justify considerable aid and support, especially since there was never really the question in the minds of most Germans, East or West, if Germany should continue as one or two countries. The solidarity tax laws ran out in 2005, but have been extended until 2019. By then, the East may have caught up with the West, or we'll see. Many projects that should be done in the West have to be put on hold to carry on with the building up the East, and some people in the West do resent that. East Germany still has a much higher unemployment rate than other regions, which does carry some potential dangers. The South, two southernmost states, that is Bavaria and my home state Baden-Württemberg, are doing extremely well, mainly because of BMW and Mercedes, but also because of the many small businesses that flourish there. Both these states have full employment and are actually seeking employees. Fortunately, the gap between the West and East is starting to shrink, and people from the West now come to the East because of its considerably lower cost of living. Especially university students like to come to Berlin and Leipzig for that reason. Leipzig was at the center of toppling the SED, or the Socialist Unity Party of East Germany. Many of you may have heard of the Nikolaikirche, which, of course, I visited more than once, it being the center where it all began. Starting in 1982, peace prayers took place every Monday at Nikolai Church. The prayers were organized by courageous ministers. Over the years, more, mainly young people, attended. These Monday gatherings offered a platform for discussions among them. Of course, they were infiltrated by government spies, and as everywhere in the country, people never quite knew whom to trust. Thus, it took a lot of courage to be part of the Monday prayer group. The church administration often tried to curb political discussions, but they were not successful. By the end of 1988, more and more people started to attend. In January 1989, a commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the murder of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht sparked the first demonstration in favor of free speech and right of assembly. It drew about 500 very courageous people. Organizers were taken into police custody, but that could not prevent further demonstration. They grew to 1,400 participants in May 2005. 2,500 in July, 5,000 in September. By then, the Monday prayers had turned into regular demonstrations that reached 20,000 by October 2nd. In spite of massive intimidation attempts by the government, over 4,000 people demonstrated on October 7, 1989, the 40th anniversary of the founding of the DDR. 2 days later, on October 9th, 70,000 people took to the streets. By then, people from all over East Germany started coming to Leipzig to participate in the Monday demonstrations around Nikolaikirche. No violence was the mantra of the demonstrators, who often held candlelight vigils. They received a lot of attention from media in the West, which probably saved them from being arrested in much larger numbers than they were. One notable participant in the demonstrations was Kurt Masur, director of the famous Gewandhaus Orchestra. On Monday, October 16, 120,000, and on October 23rd, 200,000. On October 30th, more than 300,000 demonstrated for reforms, not for unification with the West. That was not really a point of their actions at all. At that point, there were demonstrations all over the country, and the rest is history. I just want you to know that the people of Leipzig were courageous enough to start it all. If you want to see some great movies about this time, you can check out Goodbye Lenin or The Life of the Others at Manhattan Public Library. There is a statue in Leipzig on the Grimmaische Straße, close to the university in Augustusplatz. It shows five naked bronze figures: a teacher, a philosopher, a spy, a lawyer, and a bureaucrat. That is, groups in the system that kept the totalitarian ideas alive. On the statue, you can read, "Of course, you're all allowed to sacrifice a life to a principle, but only your own." That is pretty much the mindset of most Germans, East or West. As some of you know, I grew up in Stuttgart, the capital of Baden-Württemberg, but I have ancestors on both sides of my parents from the Leipzig area. That's why I was very interested in being there too. But I did not spend more than 2 hours in my hometown or in Stuttgart. I took a train from Munich to Leipzig via Stuttgart to visit my parents' grave, which took about an hour. On the way back to Munich, after my time in Leipzig, I spent a weekend with old friends about 20 miles outside of Stuttgart and had to change trains there again. When you don't have any family in the town you grew up or close friends, and if you have lived somewhere else over half your life, the relationship to the place of one's birth just changes. I believe that is true for a lot of people, perhaps especially in the United States, where people tend to be much more mobile than in Europe. However, just last week I got reconnected with some old school friends from whom I had not heard in many years. I don't want to tell you how many decades. You may think, oh my God, how old is she? Perhaps this reconnection may bring Stuttgart a little bit closer again in the future. Anyway, my sense of home is definitely much broader than being my birthplace. I always feel really good when the plane lands in Frankfurt, not only because I made it. I'm glad because I just feel different as soon as I put my step on soil there, especially, and it's also not because it's much cooler over there. When you come from very hot Kansas, it's kind of nice to get into a cool climate, but it just, something does change in my mind, and I've noticed that. But that doesn't mean that I'm unhappy or anything when I come back to Kansas. I can do much more for the German language and cross-cultural understanding at Manhattan High School than I could ever do in Germany, and so I find that a big advantage, if not a privilege, to teach my own culture and language to young Americans. And that's more interesting than living in a monolinguistic and monocultural society, well, within certain constraints. Bottom line is that every lifestyle has advantages and disadvantages. Be it married or single, having children or not having children, living in one place all one's life or moving around, or feeling at home in one or more countries in a broader sense than where one was born. The important thing in all these scenarios is to focus on the advantages of one's own life choices or circumstances instead of the downsides. I believe We have a choice in that focus, and I have chosen, for the benefit of my own mental health, to focus on the advantages of feeling at home in a very broad sense in more than one region in Germany and in more than one region in the United States. Thank you very much. Thank you. There are two posters on the door back there. One is of Leipzig and the other one of Dresden. Some people asked me if I would show pictures, and since I didn't, I thought I'd bring those two. Thank you.
Okay, we have some time for sharing at this point. Anyone who would like to ask or comment, microphone will be coming.
Elka mentioned the Candy Bombers, and there's an excellent book by that title that I'd encourage you to read. Besides explaining the Marshall Plan and what was going on in the United States with President Truman, it explains the beginning of the divide between the East and the West Germans there. But also it includes a charming story of the pilot, the first pilot to drop that candy to the children, and it follows his life. So I can't remember the author, but the title is The Candy Bombers.
Well, I have relatives who live in Athens and also in the island of Lesbos, and I hear from them that there is a strong anti-German sentiment that's developed in Greece as a result of the insistence by Angela Merkel that Greece pay off its debts by really severe austerity policies. So what have you heard? Did you pick up anything from people in Germany about that situation and about the Greeks?
A little bit. Of course, Germany has paid a lot of money to build up the East, and they are kind of reluctant to now build up Greece. But I went to a Euro conference at the Goethe Institute in Chicago just a couple of weeks ago, and I think there will be some, you know, they want to resolve the issue. I think they all do. Right now, they are saying maybe there should be a debt clearinghouse that makes the all EU countries, that is, countries that use the euro, so the eurozone, that they should all carry the debt of the zone. It is much more a political question than really a question of money, because the EU does not have that many financial difficulties. They just don't want to take the steps that are necessary to take. There are discussions of founding a euro central bank that has similar powers as the central bank in the United States. Right now, you have 17 countries with very different cultural and outlooks on things, and it's very hard to bring them all together. And there needs to be a democratization of the system, instead of the haves to tell the have-nots what to do. They need to talk more. And I think that's what I got out of. I do not know whether that answers your question, but there are a lot of discussions, and I don't consider myself a Euro specialist, so I don't want to go into any further detail.
I don't either, but there's an op-ed piece in this morning's New York Times by an American historian who specializes in German history, and his thesis is trying to make sense of the German transcendence on this austerity issue. Can be found if you look at the historical influence of Martin Luther and Lutheranism in Germany. And
I think that
there may be some truth to it. By the way, I was in Luther's country. Leipzig is very close to the area where Luther was active. But I don't think it's as much the Protestant influence. I think it's much more the history. The 20th century was just a very difficult century for Germany with regard to the inflation in the 1920s and the devalue of the currency. And people did have to tighten their belt in Germany for decades, and it did pay off. So I think their problem is that they cannot identify very easily with other cultures and perhaps other perspectives. And that's often the case when you're doing a little better than perhaps some other countries. There is that real north-south issue. And when you have a lot, as we all know in this country too, it's sometimes very hard to share. And I think part of that is coming in there too. So I think it's more the 20th century history than the Lutherans.
Yes.
Okay. Elke, it's back here, Christopher.
Yes, Chris.
Could you expand a little bit about that feeling you have when you get into Germany that you alluded to in your discussion?
It just makes my heart jump upwards. I just feel good. And it's not something I'm planning on doing or, you know, suppressing or letting it come out. It's just there. There's nothing I can do about it. It's just a very uplifting feeling for me. But it's not difficult for me to come home. I could live in Germany anytime. I could live in Leipzig. I could live in Berlin. I could live in Stuttgart. I could live in Bavaria. I would be very comfortable there. But I'm just as comfortable over here. But there is something that is triggered emotionally when I get over there. I have to say that. I guess that's normal, too.
Yeah, because what I was wanting to get at was, how can we communicate that to people who are monocultural? Because that's often, you know, whenever I've been in Europe or Italy, Spain, wherever, I have this connection. I feel very good there. And often I keep getting this thrown in my face. Well, if you like it so much there, why don't you go live there? Instead of looking at ourselves as the monocultural institution we are and becoming more diverse, mm-hmm. we tend to react here in the U.S. And so that's sort of what I wanted to talk about.
A long time ago, not to compare and not to tell people too much, well, it's like that over there, why is it not? Because when you have an accent and you come from a different culture, that's very counterproductive. But as a foreign language teacher, I tell my students, look at the map of the United States. What do people speak from? Sorry, Doug. What language do people speak when you look at California, when you go all across those 6,000 miles, and it's English. When you look at the European map, when you go from France or Spain all the way over to Russia, how many languages do you have? So it's not really, really fair to compare the two because it's just a different cultural scenario. But I think it is helpful to get out of your comfort zone. It really is helpful for everybody, no matter where they live. So that's my answer to that.
Marilyn Caldwell.
Yes.
Being a monoculturist myself, I am not sure if Germany has a state church and whether or not you will find Unitarian churches there.
Okay, well, the church question is very interesting. I think Americans overestimate the role of the church in Germany and in Europe in general. The church does not play a very important role at all. So I would say the majority of Germans have the mindset of a Unitarian, but they don't practice it, whatever we do here. But on the other hand, the churches are still very much, especially the Protestant and the Catholic churches, are still very much active, not with attracting people to come to a Sunday service, because most churches, and I hope that doesn't offend anybody, are closed for services because nobody comes. But
they still get a lot of money, and because they are supported by the government, but they use that for a lot of humanitarian efforts. There may be a Unitarian church or two in Germany, but I really do not know a lot about them. We have a relatively increasing number of Muslims in Germany. That has to do with a lot of people coming to Germany from all over the place to work. And the largest group is the Turkish population. Berlin, and I did not go to the Turkish quarters when I was in Berlin, has over 250,000 people of German of Turkish origin. Okay, and we talk about religions. I would also like to mention that we have small Jewish synagogues again in Berlin. There are several thousand people of Jewish faith. Germany still carries heavy on the burden of the Holocaust. I wanted to share with you that, for example, in Leipzig, there were more Jewish people in the East than in the West at the beginning of the Nazi regime. So more people lost their lives in these regions. Where people have lived, many houses where they have lived, they have memorials. They call them stumbling stones. So on the asphalt, there will be a plaque of all people they could trace where they have lived and the dates of their birth and their death. Leipzig has a very unusual Holocaust memorial. It is at the place of the former synagogue on the Gottschedstrasse, and the synagogue has not been rebuilt, but on that corner where the synagogue stood, there are 140 empty bronze chairs. So it's kind of a very powerful memorial, and that was as many chairs as that synagogue had. When you look at the memorial in Berlin, when you look at a picture, you don't really realize how emotional this memorial is, because when you walk down, these are these large blocks, and you go down, you really feel like there is no way out. You get a feeling of being kind of tightened up. So, but I digressed from your question. People who are members of a church, what is the English saying? They hatch, match, and dispatch in a church, perhaps. And everything else is very secular. Hatch, match, and dispatch. Okay. Are there any other? Yes. Sorry, I said that maybe too casually. Do you have any other questions?
Yes. About 10 years ago, I was in Germany. Attended a couple of conferences, the first of which was in Berlin, the second of which was in Mannheim. And to get from one to the other, I took the high-speed train. Mm-hmm. Very interesting experience going on. That thing flies. It really moves. But I remember it took most of a Sunday to do this on the train. And when we got out in Mannheim, some of the German passengers were muttering that the train was 10 minutes late. My thought was, if Amtrak was ever within 10 minutes, it would be a national celebration. But my thought was, I mean, it seemed to the Germans that the impression I got was things were deteriorating. Well, a train is 10 minutes late?
I don't think you should judge the 82 million Germans by a muttering at the train station of Mannheim. And I think that's important for anybody who travels. Just because there may be something that strikes you as odd, that doesn't mean that everybody does that. It's just like here. I mean, we are all different. And I definitely see a generational shift over there, too. The young people in Germany are really awesome and forward-looking and very open-minded. So, thank you.
Bryce, I'd like to point out that Elka's posters will be visible from the narthex when we open the doors. So.
Okay. Thank you, Elka. That was very enlightening. It fits a series of programs we've been having this year about journeys. I'm going to add to this whole memory thing in October, and I had been planning to try to develop the theme of that spiritual feeling you get when you set foot in some place that has some meaning. For example, a cornfield in Illinois, or a field in Lower Saxony, or wherever it is, that somehow when you get to be a certain age, that feeling of that memory and of experience and place really does have some effect on you. So thank you very much. We do not have a closing hymn this morning, and thank you all for coming. Yes, Mickey. Happy birthday to Dick. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dick. Happy birthday. Okay, please join us for refreshments and for conversation.